Before I dive into the conversation with the great Mark Ritson, I would like to send a short message to my German listeners. Hier geht es effektive Markenführung und die Quellen von Markenkraft. Das ist und bleibt ein komplexes Thema. Manche sagen sogar, es sei eine Kunst. Aber zum Glück eine, zu der eine Menge validierter Erkenntnisse vorliegen. Mittlerweile wurden viele Mythen der Markenführung empirisch widerlegt, international getrieben, vor allem aus dem angelsächsischen Raum. Dabei hat sich ein klareres Bild der Erfolgsprinzipien abgezeichnet, die von den stärksten Marken der Welt genutzt werden. In vielen deutschen Unternehmen ist dieses Wissen jedoch noch gar nicht oder nur lückenhaft bekannt. Zugegeben, es ist auch schwierig im Alltag mit der Entwicklung Schritt zu halten, Hype von belastbarer Substanz zu unterscheiden und es dann auch noch auf die eigene Marke anzuwenden. Doch diejenigen, die das schaffen, fällen bessere Entscheidungen und sind erfolgreicher. Damit dieses Wissen leichter verfügbar für markenverantwortliche Strategen und Kreative wird, gibt es jetzt die Markenkraft Executive Masterclass. Sie schafft an 2 Tagen strukturierten Überblick, inspiriert mit erfolgreicher Praxis von führenden Experten und gibt direkt einsetzbare Tools und Modelle an die Hand. Die Masterclass ist ideal für alle, die ihr Wissen kurzfristig auf den neuesten Stand bringen möchten, sich verlässliche Orientierung, Inspiration und mehr Entscheidungssicherheit wünschen. Also für alle, für die wir auch diesen Podcast machen. Mehr Infos und die nächsten Termine findet ihr unter markenkraft.org.
Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind.
My name is Olaf Hartmann and today's guest hardly needs an introduction, but he deserves a proper one. Mark Ritson is one of the most distinctive voices in marketing today, a man who manages to make both academics and practitioners listen. He's been a marketing professor at top business schools around the world for more than 20 years, won numerous awards for his writings, and he's the creator of the mini MBA in marketing and brand management with Mark Ritson, courses that have given thousands of marketeers worldwide the knowledge to up their game in making better decisions every day, and maybe even more importantly, confidence to argue their case in boardrooms. Personally, I count myself among his students, in the classroom and in spirit. His work has challenged many of my own assumptions, how brands grow, how strategy connects with creativity, and why long-term effectiveness and not short-term efficiency counts. In our first episode 2 years ago, we talked about the basics of how to build better brands. And this time I invited him back, so we'll revisit the influential discovery of The Long and the Short of It of Les Binet and Peter Field and explore how their insights play out in reality today. We'll discuss why discounting remains the silent killer of brand equity, what the German marketing scene can learn from the international effectiveness movement, and how to create campaigns that reliably deliver in the short and the long run. We also want to untangle the confusing terminology around distinctive brand assets, brand codes, and fluent devices, and whatever else comes up along the way, as Mark, I would say, is something like the unofficial Oracle of Delphi in the marketing world. So let's light some incense, or better, open a bottle of beer, brace yourself for some friendly swear words, and dive in. Mark, welcome back to Markenkraft.
Hello, Olaf. Good to see you again. How are you?
I'm good. Good. Good to see you. Hope you're well. Before we dive into all those topics that I just mentioned, I would like to ask you some personal questions. Is that okay?
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your background, like how you grew up. What was the first kind of work that you did and that you actually got paid for as a child or a teenager?
Oh, yes. I was a trolley boy at the Safeway supermarket. So my first main job for about 3 years was parking the trolleys back in the supermarket. And I did that for a long time and, yeah, got me through high school.
Right. And what was the first real job that you got paid for?
The first real job was working for NCR in London, marketing cash machines, ATM machines in the start of the 90s was my first proper marketing job. So I was in Marylebone Road in central London, and I was, yeah, marketing cash machines. That was an interesting
marketing
experience.
Cash machines. All right.
So NCR, they were based out of Dayton, Ohio, and they basically had government mainframes and then a lot of ATM systems. And it was my introduction to big marketing. And it was, I have to tell you, pretty boring and pretty soul destroying. And it taught me that I'm not going to do that ever again after the year I spent there.
Right. And that was right after college. So, but you didn't grow up in London. Where did you grow up?
So I'm from the very far north of England, from the Lake District. And then I moved down to London, which was a bit of a surprise, because although England is a relatively small country, when you go 4 hours south, everything changes, you know. So it was a bit of a shock to live in London for the first time. So that was my introduction to London, which is really where I consider part of my home now. But at the time it was, you know, 35 years ago, it was a strange and wonderful place.
Big difference. Well, the Lake District, I know the Sedbergh, the area around Sedbergh up there. Yeah. And I mean, that's magic. Like if the weather is good, it's Harry Potter magic.
If the weather is good. Yeah. I mean, it's, I got married there, even though my wife is Australian, and I told her months before, it's, you know, we'll get married in the middle of the summer on Lake Windermere, but it's going to rain, which of course it did. You know, it rains all the time, you know. Miserable weather. Miserable. The British have many, many weaknesses, but one of them is they don't realize how bad their weather is. Like, it's literally the worst weather in the world, right? Yeah. But nobody tells them.
Yeah. Once the sky breaks up, it just becomes magic.
Oh, it's, yeah. If you get one of those days, that's absolutely true. But you don't get them very often. But when they come, they're very good. Yeah, they're very good.
That's right. So the Northern boy went down to London. Then we come back to our topics, basically. Do you still remember where you made your first decision based on a brand, like a purchasing decision, where you said, okay, this looks similar to that, but I think I'll take that.
My first memory of all of this is probably as a first-year marketing student at university. I wrote to Coca-Cola in Atlanta and asked them for some material to help with my class project. And they sent me a bunch of stuff, and I can remember being incredibly impressed with Coca-Cola because they'd sent me this giant folder of material about the origins of Coca-Cola. And so I think it's still that Coke moment is probably where the magic of brands, for me at least, began. You know, I think it was then.
Because marketing, that's a big confusion here. Often people mistaken marketing with brand and branding.
Yeah.
People don't get it, that it's not the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a complicated thing, Olaf, because we've got it within marketing. Everyone's obsessed with advertising, which is, you know, as we do in the course, it's maybe 8% of the job. And then there's brand management, which is kind of a parallel universe to marketing and has elements of marketing, but is a more specialized niche. So yeah, it's slightly more complex than people realize. But the big problem we have is marketers who just do advertising and really only have, you know, 10% of their facilities that you know, being used.
Yeah, and most people think brand is part of marketing. It's like one lever to pull while you do marketing.
Which it can be, right? They overlap. It's a Venn diagram, which is quite complex. The way to answer it is look at any company. They will all do it differently, but some companies, brand management and marketing are the same thing. In others, they're completely separate things. So there's no consistency. It's like when you see jobs for a brand manager, you could be talking about a salary of €500,000 and world power, or you could be basically just photocopying things. You know what I mean? Like, there's no consistency in marketing. And I think that must frustrate our German listeners. Because, you know, I have a lot of time for the general German approach to many things, but I think they would be frustrated at the lack of consistency in the marketing universe, right? It's not regulated enough for them, I think, to be happy. And I think they have a point, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that also the brand is a description of the end goal of everything that marketing is doing. Yeah. So basically it's a superior principle. It's a guiding principle of why we're doing all this. Well, we want to have like a positive prejudice in moments of decisions in the future. And people should think of us more quickly and then pay more money for it. And that's basically everything.
It's a good way. It's a good way to think about it, Olaf. It's, and there's a paradox there as well, which is, You're absolutely right. It's the brand is the end result of all of our efforts, but also we control everything, all the inputs into brand, but not the brand itself, which belongs to the consumer. So there's this wonderful paradox where you can pull all the levers you like, but at the end of the day, the brand doesn't live inside the company. It's in the perceptions of the consumer. So it's a very frustrating job, you know, as well, for sure.
That's very interesting. You know, Hans Domitzlaff, who's a very early brand thinker in Germany. And he said, like, in the beginning, you are the creator of a brand and later you become the slave of the brand because it lives in heads of people, in heads and hearts of people. And then if you destroy what's living there, if you hurt it, then it hurts you. Then it becomes weak and it doesn't deliver.
It's very wise. And it's absolutely true. And when you create these brands, they initially follow what you want, and then very quickly they pick up their life of their own, right? As you become the slave, as he says. So there's this lovely moment a year or two in where they start, like children, to have their own direction, and you have to kind of go with it. You know, it starts to move in unexpected places. So yeah, it's a fantastically interesting area, and it's been great for me watching the German business culture embrace it more. You know, we had those experiences in the, you know, 80s and 90s where the German companies and the German managers just did not embrace the marketing or brand management philosophies very clearly. They did a great job, of course, but it wasn't something that I think came as easy to the German manufacturing base as other things. But I think it's been wonderful over the last 10 or 15 years, certainly the last 10 years, to see that Germany is advancing very quickly in this area of marketing and brand management. And I think they're moving fast, right? My sense is there's a real culture now of effectiveness, which wasn't there before.
You know? Still, yeah, I agree. I agree, there are signs, but still needs more. And that's the reason why we bring you in now. So you're coming to Germany soon. Looking forward to that. And definitely what you said is like the engineering approach of looking at also how to engineer brands. I think that's a very German way. But I think that many German companies and brands also have lost their way in a way, because often it's connected with people, you know, like a strong brand. There are strong people behind strong brands. And and often this is connected with that. It's not the system or the kind of culture of effectiveness. And it's just created by example, by the one that is creating, like Grundig is a very old example. And then when that person suddenly lost the touch, then suddenly the brand culture is changing. So we try with this podcast also, and talking to you now, we try to give them like more insights, like evidence-based structures and models. So let's dive in there. One of the most influential ideas in the last 15 years, over 10 years already, because it was 2013, was the long and the short of it. And for the listeners that are younger, maybe can you summarize what they found and how you look at it today, and what has it changed in the industry?
So for many, many years, I mean, when I was studying marketing, Peter Field and Les Burnett were already famous and were already very senior advertising statisticians, for want of a better word. And they spent a long time judging the equivalent of the Effies in the UK. So they would look at hundreds and hundreds of advertising submissions for the IPA Effectiveness Prize every year. And about 10 years ago, they finished an analysis of basically what makes advertising work. And they called it the long and the short of it, because what they found was, you really want to combine two very different approaches into an overall advertising campaign. You want the long of it, which is brand building, top of funnel, emotional, and usually aimed at everyone in the category. And then you want the short of it, which is targeted, more product-based, more rational, aimed at the bottom of the funnel. And they even gave us a prognosis of what's the right combination of long and short, famously 60% long, 40% short, which has since been varied depending on various other factors. But I really think it stands up, along with How Brands Grow from Ehrenberg Bass, as one of the two big pieces of certainly advertising thinking of the last 15 or 20 years. And it's a very practical monograph. You know, it's about doing the work. It's not theoretical at all. And so we got this theory, and it's been, you know, it's been a real help for marketers to try and rebalance brand building alongside shorter performance marketing and getting the right balance of the two. A couple of things, I guess, have evolved. I mean, the main one is the name was wrong. So the long and the short of it is a very nice phrase in English, but it led a generation of marketers to believe that long-term brand building takes a long time to work, and it doesn't. So the data from System One that we've subsequently got shows us that if you run a big emotional TV campaign, it will almost immediately drive product sales. And the word long doesn't mean it takes a long time to work. It means it lasts for a long time. Unlike the performance short marketing advertising stuff, which, you know, drives sales, but the minute you stop spending money upon it, it evaporates and stops moving the needle. So I think that's been a big lesson for us, is it's lasting rather than long would have been a better word. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other big lesson that subsequently happened is we found that you can make an ad which builds the brand and sells the product at the same time. Most ads do that. But the data is very clear. That doesn't work as well as splitting your money up and running more overtly brand building campaigns alongside more targeted performance campaigns and then linking them all together within a broader campaign. And I think that's where the work has taken most strong brands, is to realize you need them both, you need to link them together. And then you have a system really for growth, which I think is, mm-hmm. you know, the key message I would suggest for German marketers is not to be like the American marketers who are still not paying much attention to the effectiveness literature. You know, the German marketing economy can quickly learn from these international case studies, these very strong findings, steal the work, apply it to their work, and very quickly get as smart as anyone else. And I think that's got to be a key message from this podcast, is the data is rich, it's relatively practical, it's simple. And if you get into it through your, you know, instruction and leadership, German marketers can quickly become very advanced. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
That's definitely good news. But if you think of it, it was in 2013 that this was discovered. And that was basically the beginning, also in Germany, of like something like a performance vortex. It's like everybody has massively shifted budgets, not into brand, because that's what one of the things that they found. If you have the choice, you better invest in brand, in the long term, creating rich, emotionally charged meaning for your brand, which is relevant in moments when you need something, and then suddenly you think of that brand. Because sorry if I like, because I know that your guests, when you're on other podcasts, in English podcasts, American podcasts, they're very familiar. First of all, System One is a company that is testing the effectiveness of TV commercials, basically, but any kind of advertising. So, and they have a special system, and they're basically the gold standard of effectiveness.
Well, they're very predictive, testing. I think, Olaf. You know,
exactly.
When they say it's going to do something, it does it, right? So it's pretty impressive, yeah.
That's right. So for people, just to what you mean with System One when you mention them. And the other thing is what this means is basically that also from Ehrenberg Bass is that they find that 95% of people are not in the market at this moment. Yeah. So what are they susceptible to? Performance messages, they need to really convert quickly. Yeah. So if I look for something and I get an impulse, I need to buy immediately. But these 95% that are not looking for anything, their brains are just not open for processing that. And at the same time, they don't learn anything about the brand.
Yeah. That's right. Well, and I think the key point about this 95-5 rule, which plays very nicely into long and short, is it's too late when someone... So to give it, I always use the example of men and haircuts, yeah? So today in... Which city are you in today, Olaf? I didn't check. Where are you?
Between Düsseldorf and Cologne.
Okay. So today in Cologne... Let's say there's 100 German men, and I'll use men because women and haircuts is a more complex subject that I don't fully understand. So there's 100 men walking around Cologne. And only about 5% of them, because it varies a little bit, but the number is quite useful. Around 5% of them will be thinking, oh, I need a haircut, right? I have a date or an interview or it's just getting too long. I need a haircut. The other 95% will have no interest in a haircut. Even if you offered free haircuts at the train station, nobody would go because they don't need to spend 20 minutes getting their haircut, right? So what this teaches you is the real job of the long of it is to reach that 95%, really the 100%, and get them to think about the brand, lodge it in their memory, perhaps with a couple of associations. So when they enter the 5% needing a haircut, your brand is the one that comes to mind first. Because the key lesson is it's too late to try and do this when they enter the 5%. You can play that game with performance marketing, but it's a very difficult game. You're better off just hitting everyone all the time with that message, because we know from a lot of research that if your brand is salient, if it comes to mind first, and if it's associated with the main things, the human brain then begins to shut down, right? We don't want more than one barber in our brain. So the minute I get one in my head as a cognitive miser, my brain then says, that will do. And every time I think about this brand, it gets favorable attitude and response. And basically, you move that way. And 70 or 80% of the time, the brand that comes to mind first is the one that you purchase. So that's why we need 60, 70% of our ad spend aimed at everyone, aimed at emotion, aimed at salience, aimed at bringing the brand to mind, because it's the best way to then set up the performance, which can be very impactful too, but which is really just converting at the end what was begun much earlier. And remember, in that data of 95.5, there are 19 times more consumers in that broader non-buying group that we need to reach. Hence the fact there's more money going there than there is for performance. So I think, yeah, it's a very useful metaphor for how to think about the long and the short.
I think it's very, very well described with that metaphor, because that explains also while the System 1 data shows that while the digital ad spend, which is very performance oriented, most of it, not all of it, like influencers and some TikTok formats, they are storytelling formats and they can be very brand building, but most of it is like here. I'm here, buy me now. Yeah. And so,
That's right.
If you think of that, I think System 1 used the meta revenue to demonstrate that. It's basically 20, since then, 20 times more revenue is generated by Meta for digital ad spend. But at the same time, the large brand effect, large scale brand effect of campaigns is going down. It's like less, 25% less than it was 10 years ago.
Bah.
And this explains then, when you send a signal, like in the example that you just said, here, haircut for free now, but the brains are just not open. They don't look. Yeah.
No, so
the whole media invest is lost. So there's no reservoir to convert later. Okay. I think that's great. And where do you see, in which industry, do you see the biggest gap between that theory and practice? Are there some that are doing it better? What is your observation?
I mean, the consumer goods industries, I think have worked, they tend to be more advanced marketers, so they get it. Fast food industries have taken this on board and are using it. I think in finance is probably where you're seeing the biggest shortfall, because in finance, it's actually not a 95.5 rule. It's a 99.1 rule, in the sense that you'll only change your bank 3 or 4 times in your lifetime. So actually, you want most of your money to go on mass emotional brand building communications for finance brands, but nobody thinks that way. And they're all doing product performance based credit card stuff. So yeah, and the bit we should talk about is not only does this advertising help you win the sale, but good advertising reduces price sensitivity, allows you to charge more money as well, which is probably an even bigger advantage than just getting revenues from a large sample of the market. It's being able to charge more. So that factor on top really creates advantage.
Hmm. Fits to the data from Bennett and Field also, that the optimum ratio that they found in the financial industries was not 60-40, but 80-20. So you invest 80% in your brand and only 20 in activation. And this explains like long sales cycles. Yeah. Like many, many brains that are not susceptible at all. It buy me now for this and this price or do this and this.
That's right.
The first ones that really understand this, great advantage. So we don't have to change the world, but just make it better for certain clients. So whoever listens to this podcast and is in the financial industry has a good hint, is like changing that will deliver not only in the long run results, but also in the short run. Make your brand stronger.
No, I think this is a key point, Olaf. We're not, you know, we're not in the not-for-profit business of marketing, right? So we don't have to make the whole of marketing better. We're not trying to cure cancer. I think we want to support the German marketers who are scholars and who learn marketing and advertising effectiveness so they can get better, they can succeed, they can be more successful, and frankly, they can defeat and dominate those that don't have the knowledge. I mean, that's how the game of marketing should be played. So I think it absolutely is about unfair advantages, using knowledge and strategy to win. And I think that's something we should encourage, right?
Yeah, brand is an unfair advantage, but a fascinating one. Let's look at another aspect, which you already mentioned, is price power. Yeah, that's the goal of the brand. But many brands use discounting on a continuous basis. And you called out price promotions as one of the biggest threats to long-term brand health. Why do marketers actually keep doing this? This don't discount, add value is a clear recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is it's sometimes unavoidable. Your retail partners are insisting on this, right? And sometimes you just have to let that happen. But when we see companies themselves running these price-based promotions, it's a desperate insight into a lack of marketing knowledge. So a price promotion is probably the stupidest thing you can ever do to your business. Why do I say that? Well, when you run a promotion of 10 or 20 or 30% off, all kinds of horrible things happen. One good thing happens. You get sometimes a sales spike, but the rest of it is bad news. So the sales spike is for the most part, and we have research on this, these are sales that you're just pulling forward. Yeah, you would have got most of them anyway. All you're doing is pulling them earlier and getting them at a much lower profit point. Second, you're pissing off any customer that paid full price. Third, you're encouraging all your distributors and retailers to ask for this promotion again and again. Fourth, you're probably starting a price war with your competitors who now also start running these promotions as well. Fifth, you're commoditizing your brand. And sixth, you're destroying your profitability. So when you run a 25% off price promotion, you don't still get 75% of the profits. You're probably eviscerating almost all of your actual profitability and will be very lucky to break even. So you add all that together and you get this terrible moment where the company pulls sales forward, hurts their brand, pisses off their distributors, hurts their loyal customers. And then, of course, they haven't got any sales for a while because they've pulled them all forward and converted them already. So they look around and say, well, what can we do? Well, the one thing we can do is run another price promotion. And off we go. And before you know it, the company is in genuine trouble. So as you know from the course and the mini MBA, I'm very strong about it. There are a few examples where running a price-based promotion makes sense, but they make up 0.2% of the stories. So my line is...
Which are those examples? Like, is there a healthy way to discount at a certain moment?
Yeah, there's a couple of outliers. So one of them is running a promotion for trial can actually be a good way to recruit customers. I would argue not a price-based promotion, but still, yeah, promotions for trial work pretty well. And very rarely you can block a competitor launch by running a promotion so they're already stocked up when the new brand arrives. There's a nice play there. But these are, you know, micro situations, you know what I mean? Yeah. For the most part, this is just marketers who don't have a full training in marketing making a ridiculous mistake. But they'll often turn around and say, but, you know, the consumer expects this and our customer expects this. And you say, yeah, because you've taught them that, right? You've taught them to expect this. And the real trick is to climb out of the toilet. And there are ways to do this, and we teach it on Mini MBA, and get back to a place where promotions are, you know, are seen correctly as a necessary evil, but something that is a total failure. Whenever a marketer sells a product on a promotion, they should feel great embarrassment and shame. It's nothing to feel good about. You've failed, you know? And that's the right attitude to take, you know?
Yeah. But you also say that marketers should have more influence in setting the price in general, because that's one of those four P's which have lost the marketeers, like price, place, promotion, and product. They are just busy with that partial of that part of promotion. And why do you say that marketeers should sit at the table when the product and development team has finished the product and they think about the launch? What is the perspective that marketing can bring to the table?
It's important, I think, that we say I don't expect marketers to be in charge of product development at Audi, you know, or setting the price of the new Audi car, for example, right? But they should be there at the table. So if we take pricing as an example, most companies set prices by looking at two stupid things. The first one is the competitors' prices that are probably equally stupid. And the second, they look at costs, which has got nothing to do with it. You know, it's a tiny little thing to examine. Costs, you know, if we were all pricing based on costs, then the world would be a miserable place. What we really need to do is recognize there's a price, but before the price, there should be some good research done on essentially how much the consumer is prepared to pay. And this is something marketers can do if they're trained well. They can run conjoint, they can do Van Westendorp analysis, they can do experimentation. We are the only ones that can say this is what the consumer will pay and predict it very accurately. The second part of that is, once you've got your price, there's also then the way you communicate and frame and anchor your price to the consumer. And in my experience, and many of your German listeners will not like this idea, but I can certify that it's true. The way you present a price is more important than the price itself. Nobody knows how many euros something is going to cost, especially when they're buying 60 or 70 items in a supermarket. And so the context around the price, the way in which you show it with other products or in a certain part of the store or with a certain message, becomes far more important than the number of euros. And so in my life, I've learned on my consulting travels that, first of all, it's not about revenue, it's about profit. Second, the best way to drive profit is through price, not through sales volumes or cost cutting or anything else. Price is the lever. And third and finally, the way that you can manage and increase price comes down to marketers being involved in it. Because, you know, the finance people are very strong. Of course they are, but they're useless at research and they have no idea about communications. So I think it's an area where marketers could have a massive impact on profitability if they were trained in pricing and if they got involved, you know.
There we go. Thank you. So I always call this a Bildungs podcast. This is an educational podcast here. So I think that we've delivered already. Let's come to one topic which we were in touch on LinkedIn recently about, which is also marketing is a very fluffy kind of field, and there are many words floating around, and there one clear thought, school of thought has evolved with Ehrenberg Bass, is about being distinctive, how important it is, not about being different, but just being distinctive is super important. And this ties in well with what we talked about before, which has been researched actually in Germany originally in the 30s, the Van Restorff effect. Is like, to be different is just brain friendly. It's just people remember it. The Van Restorff was a psychologist in Berlin, and he gave lists of words, and there were all lots of animals and one tool. And then they asked people, what do you remember? And everybody remembered some of the tools and always the animal. Yeah, and then he switched it around. He made many, many animals, and there was one tool name in there. And then he asked people again, what do you remember? And they remembered some of the animals, and every time the tool.
Always the tool.
Always the tool. So sticking out is just brain friendly. So this makes every contact more efficient. Everything is there. So being distinctive is very good. But we have these different words about being distinctive and codes, and we have distinctive brand assets. We have brand codes. System one is calling them fluent devices. And then you actually added a fourth one, which was well-branded or something, some kind of
term. The old-fashioned word for it was, a well-branded ad. You know, there's lots of them.
And as in the boardroom, marketeers are considered not very precise. They talk a lot. They're very flashy and we can't rely on them. So this again makes it more difficult, like having four words for basically the same thing. What is your thinking behind it, and what is your favorite of these terms?
Well, I think, we have to fix it. I mean, I'm in the rare position for a few years where I have some influence on this process. And so I'm very keen that we choose any of the words. They all mean effectively the same thing, but we remove the others for the sake of, as you say, helping other people understand in non-marketing roles, but also new marketers arriving into the field, marketers whose first language is not English. None of this is very helpful. So I wrote an article about it where I'm proposing that we take, I've always pushed the idea of brand codes. Ehrenberg Bass have push distinctive brand assets. System One have produced fluent devices. I think we have to make a decision. And I know that Ehrenberg Bass won't change their minds. So I'm trying to work on System One along with my own syllabus to say we will accept distinctive brand assets as the name for this. But there are a couple of things in the distinctive brand asset definitions that I think we can extend and expand because they don't cover these things. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to Professor Sharp at the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, and I've proposed we might do something like this. And I think we're going to make progress. So I think next year we'll try and unify this important concept and just get the literature simplified. But it's hard because everybody wants to have their own, their own concept.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing for Germans is especially difficult because they don't understand the difference between distinct and different. I mean, even in the dictionary, the definition of different,
it's not much easier in English. I mean, the best way to think about it is distinctiveness has got nothing to do with competitors, right? Distinctiveness is, do you come to mind for the consumer?
Yeah.
Differentiation, or at least as I define it, relative differentiation, is all about the competitor. And it's all about whether we're perceived to have relatively more of certain things than the competition. So, you've got this sense of distinctiveness being, does the brand come to mind and stand out and look like itself? And relative differentiation, if it does it have more perceived strength in certain areas than the other alternatives that have come to mind? I think that's the best we can do.
When I hear you talk, I hear basically the definition of code. That's the difficult part. I know that Ehrenberg Bass probably is not going to give up on their term. But if you look at I looked it up on the Cambridge Dictionary, and it defines code as a system of numbers, letters, or signals used to represent something in a shorter or more convenient form.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what a distinctive brand asset should do. You know, you listen, you see a color and you think of the telecom, and you hear a sound and you think of whatever, Netflix, the ta-dam, and that's a code.
Well, and also you've got codification, which is the process of making something. But look, you don't have to convince me, Olaf. I mean, I've always wanted to have codes, but I think it's going to go the way of distinctive brand assets, just because Ehrenberg Bass have published all. I mean, Jenny Romaniuk is the big expert here. She has written the book.
Yeah.
So I think that gives her the power. And at the end of the day, ironically, it doesn't matter, right? We need to make the word for distinctive, so we have to get on with it.
Right. Well, then maybe the distinctive brand code, which is like basically says the same thing. Code and distinctive is basically the same, but maybe there's a path in the middle. But just talking about distinctiveness, I think we've covered that. But just what's your view on distinctiveness and effectiveness? Like just a quick, basically summary, a nutshell summary.
I think it's one of the big two or three driving factors in advertising effectiveness. And it surprises clients because they think, well, you know, yeah, of course, everybody knows the ad for, you know, Aldi is an ad for Aldi. You know, I mean, it's obvious, right? But it's not obvious because from a consumer point of view, they aren't paying full attention. They don't care. And unlike the marketers and the agency, they aren't focused on a single brand for 6 or 7 hours a day. They have 500 brands and they're paying partial attention. So, you know, what we've learned in recent years from research is in a 30-second ad, you need to, whatever we want to call them, you need to play out your codes 7 times in a 30-second ad to ensure that the consumer knows who's doing the advertising because they're not paying attention. And it's simply not good enough for marketers to have these mysterious 30-second films, and at the end you find out, oh, look, it's an ad for, you know, Volkswagen. It's not good enough. It's, you know, it, you need to weave them throughout the ad, because if the consumer doesn't know it's you, nothing else is going to happen. So, yeah, distinctiveness is right up there in terms of having an effect.
Yeah. And there was recently an interesting study which you presented, I think, in Cannes, is like if you invest in a TV commercial, the whole investment is lost if people don't remember, like what you just said, that it's you. But there's a magic number that turned out in the research. How many times or how many distinctive assets should be used, or how many times a distinctive asset should turn up?
Magic number is definitely 7, right? So handily it's 7. We need to play those codes out 7 times to be certain. And a lot of creative agencies, you know, don't like that number and they think that's ridiculous. But they have to somehow maintain creativity while still achieving that magic number, because the data is, you know, from a very large sample of ads, without that 7, it really tails off dramatically quickly.
And 6 was already half.
Yeah,
7 was exactly. Like 100%. If 7 codes were used in the ad, everybody knew who the ad was from. If 6 codes were used, only 50%.
Half had gone. Yeah,
half has gone.
This is a sample of 12,000 ads, so the numbers are meaningful. Yeah. You know, you want to, you paid for those pixels. You want to codify as many pixels as possible, because if they don't know it's you, all bets are off. You can be as emotional as you like. You can have a powerful product appeal. But if the consumer doesn't know it's you, then everything is wasted, you know?
Okay. So be distinct. And how do you achieve that? And maybe also for the creative agency, it's easier to be distinct if you have many codes which have developed than when you only have the logo. You basically need to put in the logo 7 times.
No, it's super important, right? Yeah. You can also have too many. I mean, I've worked on brands where we've created too many codes. Mm-hmm. The general, you know, if you want a simplistic rule, is logo plus 3 or logo plus 4 gives you a palette that you can then use to pretty much be distinctive everywhere, right? I mean, there's two parts to distinctiveness in the Ehrenberg Bass world. There's owning those category entry points. So you come to mind. When I think about, you know, lunchtime snacks, Kit Kat comes to mind because it just has managed to create that connection, right? But the other way is on the shelf by being distinctive and looking like yourself, jumping out. And I think it's a brilliant contribution to the world of marketing. So you need those distinctive brand assets because, again, brand managers think that, you know, they can see their brand from 500 meters away, but it's not the same for consumers. And this is the key lesson of market orientation, right? No one else is paying attention.
Yeah. Why do you think so few brands manage to protect and invest in the long run in their distinctive brand assets? Because you see that constantly. I always say it's probably the one of the biggest like destruction of value in the world of marketing is like letting go of strong distinctive brand assets or brand codes and just not use them anymore. Just like even Audi, like talking about German brands, Audi in China has like left out the rings. It's just writing Audi on the cars
insane.
Without the rings. It's insane.
But marketers seek new things, right? They look at those rings literally 10,000 times, and they say everybody's sick of the rings, right? What they're not realizing is consumers don't spend that much time. And when they see it 2 or 3 times a year, it jumps to mind, and the familiarity is a big advantage. So it's just a lack of market orientation that leads them. They turn over the ads too quickly. They change their distinctive brand assets too often. And it's a failure of market orientation, yeah. You know, and it lies at the basis of a lot of marketing problems. You are not like the consumer. And if you see the world like the consumer truly sees it, everything you do changes. You run ads longer, you make them more distinctive, you keep the same distinctive brand assets. The other big one is you realize your brand is not very important. Nobody cares about your brand's attitude to global warming. You know, if it helps you and your employees, that's great. And if it's the right thing to do, that's awesome. But don't expect it to have a big impact on consumers, because consumers don't care what your brand does, right? Now, if I go up to you with an attractive young man or woman and with a clipboard, I say, do you think it's important that brands are part of the environmental solution? You go, of course, yes, yes, yes. But that's not how consumers think. When we do research that asks consumers to explain, why did you buy the products you bought yesterday? And we don't cue them with, you know, the environment and brand purpose. What we find is these 70 or 80% of the consumers saying, yes, it's very important that brands have environmental credentials. We see those numbers dip down to 2 or 3%. Yeah. Mm. Because when we don't prompt consumers, we get much closer to an accurate portrayal. My point throughout this crazy 10 years of brand purpose has been, it doesn't mean we shouldn't do the right thing for the environment. We should do that. But let's not kid ourselves that we're going to make more money and get more customers and be more profitable because of it. That's a naive thought. We choose to do the right things because they are the right things, not because we're going to benefit. There's a great parallel in German history, right? For the unification, the West Germans knew they were going to lose an enormous amount of economic growth while they returned Germany to a single country. They didn't think they were going to benefit from it in the short term, but it was the right thing to do. These were still, you know, German people. I think we've taken brand purpose in the wrong direction. Do the right thing because it's the right thing. You know, the purpose of purpose is purpose. But don't try and pretend it's going to give you also, by doing the right thing, we're going to make lots of money. Life is not that simple. It's almost certainly going to cost you money to do the right thing. And you have to be ready for that. And I think that mature debate is still not yet happening in marketing.
But it's dying down now. I mean, Germany, definitely. The purpose wave is again low. And like you said, there's definitely towards the inside, towards the employees, it can have a great effect to give them really purpose to, you know, roll out of bed, walk into an office every morning, and spend part of their life giving their energy to something. And if they have the feeling that this is for something good in the world, that is very important, but it's not at the point of sale that people are willing actually to spend more money. First they want the function of the product, and very rarely. Yeah, exactly. If it's built in, like I always use Patagonia as an example, the function of the brand is also to enjoy the environment, the outdoor environment. So if it's embedded into that jacket, that will actually support what's my ultimate goal with that jacket. Completely understandable that it makes the jacket more attractive. Yeah. Mm. And it also becomes something like a signaling value also. Yeah. As something, hey, I wear Patagonia and I show to the world that I care, and that can be worth something. And it definitely is.
I think that's a good summary. And we've got the data on this now, right? We've been looking at it for a while. These purpose-based campaigns don't work as well as non-purpose-based campaigns. And we have to accept that, you know, that there is this problem in the empirical data. Again, doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but it should make you realize there's a cost to doing this that must be borne out.
If it doesn't cost you anything, it's not a real purpose. It's like a caritative purpose.
It's true.
Mark, you said something else. You say so many great things, but one of the things you said about, you know, how to make actually campaigns work is that you said great advertising is persuasion disguised as entertainment. What in your view are timeless ingredients that make ads work? And I know you're close with System One, and just let's riff a little bit on that topic. Okay, what is the current evidence? What makes campaign really tick?
Look, we've already mentioned the distinctiveness, right? So the presence of distinctive brand assets. There's probably two more. We have to put emotion into the mix because, again, we go back to the 95%. The consumer who isn't interested in haircuts, we've got to make them interested by using emotion and narrative structure and involvement, because right now haircuts are not top of mind. So I think that role of creating an emotional charge, it supercharges the impact of the ad. And often we say emotion, and maybe your German listeners get worried that we're talking about, you know, children crying and so on. There is a broad wheel of emotion. That can be fear, that can be humor. You know, there's lots of emotional buttons that can be pressed through good storytelling, which have a massive impact on advertising effectiveness. So I would start there. And then the other one is time. You know, we tend to not bake our cakes long enough in advertising. The data is mostly pointing to 2 or 3 years of the same campaign being the most productive and effective executional length. Most campaigns are done within, you know, a couple of months. It should be 12 times longer.
Six months, most likely. I see that constantly. Like they run them 6 months and then they need something new. And that's really good news because it saves money also. And it's
We find a couple of things from the data, right? First of all, old ads that are good get better and stronger. You know, the holidays are coming from Coca-Cola. It isn't just a 15-year-old ad. It's a 15-year-old ad that gets better over time, according to the data. But second, if you don't have to spend 20% of your budget making a movie and you can put it all into the working capital of media, you're going to see a boost of 20% right there and then, right? That's a vital injection of extra effectiveness. So yeah, you can spend all your money on media. Your ad is going to work better. And we see it again and again in the data. The top three Christmas ads in the UK last year were ads that had run in previous Christmases. You know, so these ads are strong. And marketers, unfortunately, think they're in the business of making new ads. And that's not why they're being employed. They're being employed to build brands and have effective ads. And that usually means using old ads and not making new ones all the time, even though it's fun and cool and sexy.
So wear out is a myth. That's
pretty much
summary of that. Yeah. Has there been any wear out measurable in this study?
No, I mean, there's a caveat in the sense that maybe with the performance and shorter term digital stuff, there is a wear out effect. This is more in the big brand building stuff. But no, that for the most part, when we've gone and looked at these campaigns, research companies are concluding that ads are continuing to work. And as I say, most of the time work better. I have good friends with the team at Tourism Australia. They've run their campaign for 3 years. They've now introduced a new campaign. And I said to the CMO, Susan, why? You know, what was wrong with the old campaign? She said, oh, no, it was still working even better in year three. But we have new things we have to talk about and we need a new launch campaign and there's, you know, new priorities. So I understand, but it just shows you most campaigns, good ones, will keep getting better. And therefore, the logic is keep running them.
Yeah. We're always joking, my partner and I, we always joke we need to create another award because nobody wins awards for keeping a campaign on, like keeping the cake in the oven. We should have an award for keeping the cake in the oven.
Absolutely.
Like we were seeing like the steering wheel of a ship and the hand, like a golden hand, a steady hand on the steering
Good
wheel.
Idea.
That is the trophy.
Look, you make a great point. If you look at all the work at Cannes, it's the work from the previous year. So there's a limit set in
place. An incentive problem here. There's like within the industry, there's an incentive problem. Yeah. Let's talk about the industry. You've observed marketing cultures across the world. When you look at Germany, what is your impression? Like, where are we? And
it's a great. I mean, the German market is obviously huge, right? And you always got that sense if they really got into marketing to the same degree as they're into finance or into engineering, it would really be quite a revolution. And I think for many years, the obsession with product engineering and the hard facts of how products work was such a strength for German engineering, but such a weakness for German marketing. But I really think now we're reaching a place where that great sort of German culture of business is now really absorbing marketing. So, yeah, I see it as being a very interesting period now. I mean, from my point of view, my business is in training. I can tell you Germany is our most interesting market. It's big, it's smart, it's unpenetrated. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking very good German with AI now because we'll try very hard next year to get into Germany. So yeah, I think it's an exciting time for the German marketing scene, right? And we're seeing it at conferences. We're seeing it in the quality of the thinking. You know, I think there's a good group now of German scholars who are, and it only takes a small handful, who are sharing the news and we're getting somewhere. And I think it's a great thing. I mean, if you look at why has effectiveness developed so much over the last 10 or 15 years? It's because the universities have become less important and people like you and people like me have had more influence. And the universities are great, but they're very closed doors, right? They've done a great job of also removing access from all of the great information. And I think, you know, things like your podcast are a much more democratizing way to share the information. So I think Germany will have a great decade of marketing, and I think it's a very exciting time. You agree? Or I mean, you know better than me. What do you think, Olaf?
I do agree. There's a movement growing. There's still a lot of way to go, but in the past, there was a time where really at top level management, brand and marketing had a place, and that has been reduced in the last 20 years. Basically, the most ambitious people went into other places. So there was a recruiting problem because marketing, like you said, reduced itself to creating some pretty pictures. Yeah, it's like basically just communication, and so I think that it attracted many people that were attracted to this glossy world. Yeah, but then in the boardroom, they don't have the evidence, they don't have the hard facts to argue for the case of the brand, and that has been a problem, and that is changing now. But it used to be better, and I think. It can come back. But overall, if you look at what Germany has invented over, you know, so many years and who made the money from it, it was mostly American companies or other companies. Like, we invented MP3, who made the money with it? It was Apple with the iPod. We invented so many things that other people just so the connection between, like you said, the engineering quality and then understanding that communicating and really making the value tangible, that is one sphere, and it's not one or the other or one and the other. It's like it must be thought together from the beginning. Yes. So what you are, and I know that you do that, it's the, your kind of thinking is exactly what we need to get more into more acceptance, more budget, and also more visibility for basically that marketing train of thought of how to make our companies again into powerhouses that develop and market in the same way they develop. So that's my feeling right now. And I think that it's even politically, like, to be honest, do we have a chance to work harder than the Koreans? The Japanese have a word for working yourself to death. We don't have that. Yeah. We don't have a word like that. So on that performance level, I think that whatever we invent, it will be copied quickly, like, latest after 20 years, but right now much, much earlier, I think. So on the functional level, we will not be able to differentiate our products. So we only have the chance to do it on the level of process and meaning. And that is brand. Yeah.
And I think you see it with automotive at the moment, a perfect case study where you know, what is the key strength of German automotive now? They're still great cars, but the Koreans, the Chinese are now, if anything, slightly ahead, right, in the electric vehicles. But we have these great iconic brands that represent luxury automotive, and the Chinese and the Koreans aren't able to build them, right? And I think, so where is the strength in the German economy? It's a lot more with brands than it used to be, yeah? And I think it really is a source of corporate advantage for Germany that they have this, you know, this incredible array of brands. I hope they continue to manage them well, right? But it's their real core competence now.
And you worked for a long time in France or internationally for LVMH, which is a great example. I mean, like France has still had this culture of keeping that value in brands. Like, look at the companies there, and you've built the brand academy for them. So, without reason.
But the French way is very different, right, from both the German and the English way. But you're right, the French culture and the French focus on, you know, a maison and a marque, they're very, very specialized, and they're very proud of their brands and very proud that they do it in a certain, you know, French way. I think there could be that same pride in a German school of branding, you know, that it has a real potential to be different from the French school or the American school, but still be a very, you know, a very major contribution force. I think it has huge potential. Yeah,
that's a good thought for the future. So let's sum up just some on a personal thing again. Like your columns have been very influential. They were always very sharp, funny, brutally clear, and now you are spreading out a little bit. Just give us an update. Where can we have more of Mark Ritson besides Markenkraft podcast?
So I did Mark. I started writing for about 10 years for Marketing Magazine in the UK. Then I moved to Marketing Week. And then when Mini MBA moved, I wasn't connected to Marketing Week anymore. So I thought, well, it's a chance to move again. So I write in Europe for The Drum. And I write in America now for Ad Week. And they're both going very, very well. I would like to write for Horizont at some point in Germany, and we could start writing about this. But it's at the moment, it's enough to do two a week, you know, for the Americans and the British. But eventually I have my eyes on Horizont, and I have my eyes on Resume, which is the big Scandinavian. If I could get those four going, I'd be very happy, you know. And you have to write something different for each one, of course. So that's where my work is now. And it's always in front of the paywall. So Adweek is about a Wednesday, and The Drum is usually on a Monday morning. Mm. And yeah, the columns go well. I mean, they keep getting read, so I'm very happy.
Great. So if you do, I'll keep my listeners informed. So as a summary, basically, because I don't know how you perceive it, but I think that the sea is rough right now, like in many ways. Like people are anxious, marketers are anxious. They don't want to miss anything important. Again, you know, like, what does AI mean for our industry? How does it change? There's turmoil. Da, da, da. Just from you have a you can see patterns because you have lots of experience for a long period of time. What would be the three topics you would say my listeners should focus on in the next 12, 18 months?
Look, I think we're going to see, first of all, the first German insight is to really study the world of advertising effectiveness. We have a very complete practical theory. I think every German marketer should start there. Second, I think they have to watch out for what's coming again here, which is we seem to be in this pincer movement of, I think we'll get more inflation again, but all the retailers are trying to reduce prices. And I don't know how that plays out over the long term. It's a very, very tricky one. And then I guess the final one is really thinking about this AI change that comes in the 30s. You know, the synthetic data is in my experience now is probably superior to consumer research. It certainly will be very shortly, not just cheaper and faster, but more accurate. And so that opens up this era of building synthetic marketing plans and synthetic brand plans using unlimited amounts of market research in real time. I think that's Probably. And that's not happening yet. I think we're still a couple of years away from it. But I think we will get to a place where building great marketing plans is essentially done using AI. I think that's the big one to watch. And it comes in the 30s and changes the nature of many things that we do in a really revolutionary way. But it'll take a while.
Okay. So summary, keep on learning. Stay light on your toes.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, if you've got kids, you look at the world ahead and you say, well, it's going to be great. But it's also going to be different again, you know? And I'm not sure formal education is as useful now as teaching kids to be, as you say, you know, agile and able to learn and change. I think that might be the great skill of all. And certainly for marketers, you know, I feel a lot for the, you know, I'm in my 50s now, you know, and I've always wanted to work in marketing. I feel a lot for the 20-year-olds who want to be marketers, but aren't sure that marketing will be there for them over the next 30 or 40 years. It's something that it never bothered me, you know. So I think we do have to, you know, train marketers to be flexible and agile, because they'll need that, because it is going to, the process is going to change again and again now in a quite dramatic and interesting way. And I think that's great, right? But it's challenging.
Yeah. But it basically supports what we said before, is like, if you understand marketing in a proper way, it's not going to go away. The people are going to call it the chief growth officer or whatever. But if marketing is going back to the table to discuss, also not decide, but discuss about price, if it helps influence product development, if it is listened to in sales processes and does amazing campaigns and communicates the brand promise well, then who wouldn't want an employee that can actually do all this? So this is a cross function. And
that's right.
And from my point of view, like, AI will replace everything that is very focused and very narrow very quickly, but especially the cross functions that need creativity, open-mindedness, social skills, emotional skills. So I think that I see a great future for marketing, but only for the properly understood marketing, evidence-based marketing. And we have the body of knowledge, like you said, so it's time to learn. If you want to finish this, like, with a motivational quote on the screen of all my listeners when they open up their laptop in the morning for a year, and you could put something there, what would you put there?
I think you know the answer to this. I'm a big fan of a post-it note that should be on every marketer's laptop that says, "Customers don't give a shit," and it's a reminder that that there's a great ad planner called Sarah Carter who came up with this idea that she said everybody who works in advertising should have a post-it note right by their desk that says customers don't give a shit, because they don't. And it's a great reminder that they don't notice, they don't care, you know, and that we should build our work accordingly. And so that's definitely the thing to stay with, is customers don't give a shit. And if you understand that, you make better work.
Yeah. Be more consistent, repeat your message many, many times, because they don't learn it the first time. Be visible and recognizable,
yeah.
Keep it simple, recognizable out of the corner of your eyes. So it sounds negative, but actually it's a very, very good advice. So your customers don't give a shit every morning on the laptop. Mark, it has been a real pleasure again. Thank you very much for your insights.
Good to see you again, Olaf. And I'm looking forward to a beer in Düsseldorf in the next couple of weeks, right?
It's going to happen. Yeah. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen, und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Soundcloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.